Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this final edition of General Talk from the Army Benevolent Fund. There's something about a soldier that is fine. Fine, fine. Noel Gay's closing lyrics to his 1933 march of the same name, performed by the Band of the Grenadier Guards under the direction of my old friend Major Stuart Watts. An appropriate tune to welcome you to the last General Talk as we bring the long-running series to a close after five very happy years. My guest on the podcast as we mark Women's History Month is General Dame Sharon Naismith, Vice Chief of the Defence Staff and Master of Signals. A modest, quiet-achieving trailblazer, she has enough military firsts to her name to put many Olympic champions to shame. Of the armed forces, she says, it is irrelevant what our background is, what our gender is. It is all about the team. I hope you enjoy the programme.
General Dame Sharon Naismith, if we may start, you are the first woman to hold the rank of general, the highest-ranking female officer in the British Army. It's June 2024. You've been Vice Chief of the Defence Staff. Prior to that, you were Deputy Chief of the General Staff, the first woman to command a brigade, the first woman to command a divisional level formation. I know that you make light of such achievement, but as we mark Women's History Month, my first question is, can you imagine any one of your male comrades on the Army Board achieving the same, bringing up two sons at the same time?
Oh, I can, yes, because they do. We all do, don't we? We all play our part in our role modelling as parents at home at the same time as doing what is much more than a day job, serving in the forces. But yes, I think my fellow Army Board members, or indeed Executive Committee members in my current role, face the same challenges. I suspect many of them would say the only way we keep the show on the road is a team effort. And whether that's a team in work or frankly the team at home, it's the only way that we can achieve it. But I am very glad that I have two sons that I would like to think, or was they tease me, I like to think in very many ways see the career that I've been fortunate to have as incredibly normal. Why wouldn't they have a mum that could have done all of that? Which is a brilliant thing, and is definitely a thing to celebrate.
Very much so. In 1988, when you went for a probationary commission at Sandhurst, all going to read biological sciences at Edinburgh, the picture was very different then. You were commissioned into the Royal Army Corps. Why did you join the Army when your career path at that stage was very restrictive? It was limited, and certainly as female officers, you were certainly very second rank, as it were, in terms of the very male-dominated society the British Army was at the time.
It's a great question. I mean, genuinely a great question, because when I sometimes voice out loud the environment that I and my fellow service women joined at the time just is so far removed from anything that we would think is acceptable today or attractive. And I'm almost slightly embarrassed when I describe the environment that I joined. But at that point in time, it didn't feel that way, which I think is a reflection of how society has moved, and a very, very significant transformation in our armed forces. There will always be more to do, but I am very proud of some of the transformation that I see in the organisation that I joined to the organisation that I serve in today. I mean, at the heart of why I joined at that time, which is the same as I think the reason people join today, is my brother was joining. He did a lot of talking about he was going to do, and I thought I could have a bit of that. Thank you very much. I'm forever.
What did he join?
He joined the Royal Scots. And in many ways, we are very different. But he talked about it. And I thought, I want that. I want to go and, you know, it's a profound, good thing to go and do, purposeful, rewarding, challenging, all of that. It never occurred to me, I suppose my family upbringing, it never occurred to me that I couldn't or shouldn't do that because of my gender. So I didn't see the differences, I think is what I'm saying. I saw the opportunity. And at the time, I didn't see what now feels very uncomfortable constraints. I didn't see them. I only saw the things that I could go and do. you know, the Women's Royal Army Corps, which by the time I then commissioned into regular service in 91, my generation at Sandhurst were the first generation that we recap badged. And I'm very grateful to what the women that served in the Women's Royal Army Corps did.
So you commissioned into the Royal Signals, and this is where sort of the culture was beginning to change. People were beginning to realise that actually that you were more than capable. Do you think that working alongside your male counterparts, that you actually helped raise the bar somewhat in their standards?
I'm not sure I would describe it like that. I never saw that it was about my gender. There was plenty of people around me that perhaps did, but for every person around me that would, I don't know, they would say, are you sure you want to go and do that as the first woman to do that job? I think probably kindly meant, but in many ways an utterly ridiculous thing to say, because I never saw it about a gender. It was about the job that I was going to do. I was selected to do it on, you know, on merit, and it full stop. End of story.
You're listening to General Talk with me, Harry Bucknell, and my guest, Vice Chief of the Defence Staff, General Dame Sharon Naismith, as we discuss the sensitive issue for any family, the adoption of her two sons.
It was Higher Command Staff Course at the time, and I fretted a lot about telling the system, because these are sort of the soft barriers that just exist. I fretted a lot about telling the system that I didn't want to do that because we were adopting our sons. And I had convinced myself that it was over, that I wouldn't get another opportunity to compete and be selected, that I wouldn't be able to balance the two. And I worked for a general officer at the time, Bruce Brealey, who took me into his office and said, "Will you just calm down? Just stop." And he reframed it completely for me and said, "Stop overthinking everything. Of course you've got to go and, you know, it's important to you that you take the time when you're adopting your sons." And he reframed it in a way that no system policy could ever do. It was a human leadership touch that empowered me to see a way through it. And I haven't seen him, but we've been in touch since. And I'm not sure that he realized at the time just how profound that was. But it was a make or break to me. And that was soft barriers, not hard barriers.
Actually, in a way, that's the nature of bringing the army. It is a huge family. But if you had a superior officer who had any hint of misogyny about him, that could have finished you off completely, couldn't it?
Completely. Completely. And I had done it to myself. I'd convinced myself that it wasn't workable. And what I needed was an empathetic leader around me that helped me see another way. Which we really, you know, it's like one of the most important things we can do for our people.
When you got commissioned into the Royal Signals in 1991, July 1991, did you ever think that you'd rise to such giddy heights as you have done?
Not a chance. Not a chance. No, no. Oh, I think we're all... I think the majority of us join because we're profoundly committed to what we're here to serve. We're profoundly committed to those we serve alongside. We sort of live in the moment of enjoying the job we're doing. We've probably got our sights on the next step. I'm not sure how many of us think too many steps ahead of that. And genuinely, I have loved what I've done and have kept doing it and have been surrounded with some fantastic people. So for the days that are less good, there's more days that are really, really good. And I have been fortunate that I've had people around me that have helped me navigate the path. But no, did I ever think that? Not a chance.
You blazed the trail. In July 2014, when the exclusion on women serving in the Teeth Arms was lifted, how do you think that would be received within the Teeth Arms, the infantry and the armoured corps?
So the most important part of that was, as an organisation or as an institution, that we were able to say for the very first time to 50% of the population, you can join and do any job you want. When you reflect back, and it was 2014 before we could say you can join and do any job you like. I mean, that seems odd. So that was the most important thing. my lived experience, when we operate as teams, whether that's in an operational context or it's a day-to-day context, when we know each other, see each other, hear each other, we understand what we bring, what our contribution is, it is so irrelevant what our background is, in this instance, what our gender is. It's all about the team. And more often than not, we get that very, very right. So I had confidence that that is exactly how it would play out for women serving in combat roles. That is not to say this, you know, there's been significant challenges, and we've had some very strong, courageous women that have chosen that path and have proved it. And I think we've also got some strong, courageous leaders, male leaders, that serve alongside them. But at the heart, what we're all about is the team, and the team is nothing to do with background, gender. It's all about what you bring to the team.
Well, one of your previous roles on the Army Board was General Sekwani, Army Recruiting and Initial Training. How do you feel that in the current situation where we are looking to expand the armed forces once again, how do you feel that we're going to approach recruiting to get the people to come in? So we're all saying we can have an army of 150,000, but if we can't recruit 150,000, we've got a problem. How do you think we approach that, and how do you think we reach out to all aspects of British society?
One of our biggest challenges is for the nation to perhaps see what we do and see the imperative of national security as a whole of society challenge, and to put the two together. And I think we have struggled to tell the story of what life in the armed forces means. And sometimes the brilliance of what we do can be drowned out by aspects where we have got it wrong. Telling that story of what it means to be an army or navy, air force, service personnel, we struggle to do. And I think, and me and my goodness, this has accelerated over the last couple of months, but what national security means to the nation has not been a national debate. I think that tide has turned and is turning, you know, in the Prime Minister's words, you know, it's sort of a new era. And I think the combination of those two things mean that how we recruit and bring people into the service, how they serve, that they perhaps are in a position where they can dial up and dial down, whether it's regular or reserve service. So we're much more agile about that across a whole enterprise, which is a national enterprise, industry, and those that serve, and our civil servant colleagues that serve alongside us. It feels like that's a very different conversation. That is the sweet spot so that we can build the armed forces that we need to face those challenges.
I knew they didn't hold the army recruiting brief now, but as Vice Chief of Defence Staff, you certainly hold the personnel brief. Do you think having the recruitment system itself farmed out to contractors is a hindrance to recruiting itself?
No, I don't think. I mean, what we want is a recruiting system that is contemporary, has professional recruiters at the heart of it, has a back office system that enables through data and digital, that enables us to be able to attract the right workforce, track them through the system in a very agile, flexible way. All of that, you don't necessarily need a service person to do it. You need a professional organization that provides that service. We need to tell our story. Serving personnel need to tell the story. But I think the engine about how we deliver that across all three services needs to be professionalized. And I think that's the advantage that we have of doing it alongside a contractual partner.
As I hinted, you're involved with the personnel of all armed forces. You're also involved with the future shape of our armed forces. And if we've got the Strategic Defence Tribune with Lord Roberts about to present its findings in the next 2 or 3 months. You must have been directly working at the heart of that. I imagine that in the last few weeks, most of the paperwork for that must have been torn up and starting again, actually.
So the Strategic Defence Review and the review team, it was a very powerful way to understand the context of national security, what that means for defence as part of a broader system, and what that means that we need to transform from an armed forces perspective. So all of that goodness is absolutely valid. what has continued to change is the world has got even less certain and more disruptive. The threats are escalating. And our nation and our Prime Minister has definitely recognised that challenge and in a very profound way has shifted the budget for defence, really profoundly so. What that enables is for our defence review to sort of headline the things that we know we need to do. And of course, that new budget is the first step in us being able to do that. So the two coming together is profoundly important. And I think that's what we will see play out in the next couple of months when it all becomes more public.
How have you found, as a soldier, working with your fellow senior officers in the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy, and also with Lord Robertson, who's an extremely capable Secretary of Defence, and also with Secretary General of NATO, so he knows his stuff, and he's a very much respected politician. How have you found working with them to bring this, draw this sort of plan, the principles of the future together?
So I love working in a joint environment. 100%, we are about an integrated force, and that's across all three services and our people that work in Strategic Command. It's what we do. So working alongside is very rewarding. What I have really enjoyed about having an external review team is that, they literally had challenge panels. So there would be a very dynamic two-way conversation about what are the challenges and how should we meet them. And then in a sort of diverse world, that's really important that we sort of have an external view that challenges an internal view to make sure that we get to the right answer. I think that was the intent of having an external review team. And from my perspective, it makes it even more important that the outcome is not just the view of those inside defence, which could be seen as, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? It's much more than that. And I think that's very powerful and therefore has been enjoyable.
There's a huge equipment and infrastructure gap to be bridged. But do you think even so that in due course that we can fill that gap and create something credible with, say, a 5% rise in defence terms?
What I think has always been clear and has been very clear from our political leadership from day one, has been the focus that we should place on NATO first. And that doesn't necessarily mean NATO always, but it was really holding us to, we are safe through the alliance provided by NATO, and we should be prioritising our contribution to that. We've seen that played out. And also that we see ourselves as a strong European leader within NATO. I think that's what we see playing out. So in a way, that was the direction that we got on day one from our political leadership. That's what we see now manifesting itself, and even more important than it was at that time. What we will need to do is understand what that leadership means in terms of our armed forces and what we need to be able to do. The defence review will definitely set those headmarks, and then we will need to lay out how we deliver that for the nation.
You mentioned that everybody has that next step, they're looking for the next step, pretty much reached the top. You can't go no further. What's the next step, do you think, for General Dame Sharon Naismith?
Oh, I think I've got enough on my plate just now. No, I mean, genuinely, I came into this post. I'm not sure at the time I realised just how much life was going to turn on its head. But if I look at the operational context, the geopolitical context has really shifted in that relatively short period of time. Under our new political leadership, the clarity of a defence review describing what it is that we need to deliver, and my part in that is the Vice Chief. And then the third aspect is how we deliver it. We need to reset how defence operates so that we spend every single penny that has been given in a defence budget wisely, that we are able to spend it more quickly on the things that we need, that means that we're one step ahead of our adversaries. I mean, that reform is a really significant challenge for us as a department. But the combination of those three things, I've got enough on my plate for the time being, thank you.
It must be quite an exciting time to be in the armed forces right now, because we've seen a steady period of decline really since the 1990s. in terms of size and in terms of equipment and capability. And now suddenly it's all turning around. That must be quite exciting, isn't it, for you?
So it is exciting and it's rewarding. And then, of course, what our people do fabulously, almost regardless of whether that's a downward trajectory or an upward trajectory, is they get on with the job that they're given. They do it brilliantly, and then they go for the next one. And I guess that's what kept us in the game, because genuinely, that's what made us come to work and serve to lead. So in a way, that's what our people are doing. What I think, and it goes back to your point about recruiting and telling the story of what our armed forces are about, which is transforming, using military technology in a way that keeps us one step ahead, that has innovation at its heart. All of that is very exciting for our service personnel. And when we give our war fighters the opportunity to sit alongside a technical expert, that is that's how we learn to fight differently and to be able to win. That's very exciting. So we need to tell that story better. And of course, it's now in a context of national security, is much more a national debate. And I think, linking the two together is a profound shift.
The army that I left in 1996 is completely different from the army today. You must be very proud of that change, that great team spirit that you talk of all the time, the fact that everybody feels as one, and that there is equality and diversity. You must be very proud of all that. What's your sort of take on it all?
Oh, I am really proud of it. There are parts of our organisation that we still need to do better, without a doubt. But my lived experience has been to serve alongside some brilliantly talented people, where we're profoundly focused on what it is that we're here to do. And we're proud to do it. That's a secret sauce, isn't it? In very many ways. Whilst I look back at the organisation that I joined and think, oh my word, because there was a whole load of hard and soft barriers that are not now even remotely attractive, then see what I have been fortunate enough to be able to do. Never would anybody have said in either 1988 or 91 when I commissioned that was the way it was going to pan out. And that's a remarkable thing. And roll on the day when it feels less remarkable, but at the moment it's remarkable, and we should celebrate what service in the armed forces for women can feel like.
At every level?
Yeah, absolutely, at every level. We have some brilliantly talented women that I think see the opportunity of what service life offers, are very committed, courageous on some occasions because it can feel isolated, but they do brilliant jobs day in, day out.
It's great to see. If we went back to that day in 1988, you're turning up at the steps of Old College with your ironing board, what would your advice be?
So I can see this now. I definitely wouldn't have seen it then. But what I would often say to young women and men, for that matter, is be comfortable in your own skin. It took me a long time to realise that some of the value added or my contribution, where I saw things slightly different or I felt I was slightly different, my perspective, my experiences, the value add was that I had a slightly different perspective. So feel comfortable in your own skin. My second one that I've already referenced, actually, is see the opportunity, not the barriers. We've come a very long way to remove the hard barriers, policy barriers, but there are still soft barriers, behaviours, culture. But see the opportunity, navigate your way through it, rather than being distracted with the barriers. Thirdly, I would say there'll be a whole host of people around you that will feel some of the same anxieties that you might be feeling right now as you progress. Do a reach out, hand out, stronger together, the network. And then my last bit was have a bit of fun. There's a lot of fun to be had. Embrace the fun.
Now, you're a proud Northumbrian. What do you say to the old soldiers who do agree with women being in the army?
Oh, I'd say judge me on what I do, how I do it, and the outputs, not on what you see when you look at me.
Finally, looking back on your career, if you had one moment you say this was the greatest day, what would that be?
So I don't know that it would be a greatest day thing, but for a long time, I hesitated to celebrate that what I was doing in a role modeled. I didn't do enough of celebrating the fact that it was important that I was also doing that as a woman. Because, you know, if, as I said earlier, actually, it was never about my gender. It was, it was just about doing what I wanted to, what I saw was important. So I don't know about it's the best day, because it wouldn't be a single day. But I think that would be the mark of a shift where it's, we can proudly celebrate that we are a very diverse workforce, and that it no longer becomes a thing that we have to talk about. It's just the everyday. To be operationally affected means it's a diverse workforce. Full stop. And the reason that I'm still serving is because I still think that, you know, we still think we can make a difference. And I still feel I can make a difference as being the vice chief.
I think we're very lucky to have you. General Dave Sharon Naismith, Vice Chief of the Defence Staff, thank you so much for being my last guest on General Talks. I'll be having you on the programme. Thank you.
It's really good to see you again.
And my thanks once again to General Dame Sharon Naismith for being my guest on the programme. From Sarajevo to the Iranian embassy siege, apprentices, foreign correspondents, veterans, war artists, the speaker, bobsleigh champions, regimental sergeant majors, chiefs of the defence and general staff, and even government ministers who've been urged to keep being a pain in the arse. The last 5 years have been a privilege. You can find the full archive at armybenevolentfund.org. And please do not forget that the Army Benevolent Fund is here to safeguard our soldiers, veterans and their immediate families, so they can live a life of independence and dignity for the service they have given for our freedom and liberty. It is the debt we owe them yesterday, today and tomorrow. With my thanks to Generals Martin Rutledge and Tim Harms for their support, and my wonderful series editors, Jenny Redman and Natasha Theobald, ably promoted by the industrious Lola Abdelina. I hope you've enjoyed the series as much as I have making the programmes for it. Thank you for listening, and remember that there is something about a soldier. For me, Harry Butnell, look up, keep smiling through, and goodbye. With great gratitude to Sergeant Andrew Greenwood of the Royal Air Force for his help and assistance. Studio editing was by Michael Siliani. This has been a Gamekeeper production for the Army Benevolent Fund.
So I'm about to show you a picture here. This is a photograph of you on your passing out parade at Sandhurst. And that chap on the horse.
How did you get that?
The chap on the horse behind you.
Yeah,
is
that's
me.
You. That's brilliant. Wait a minute. I hope I'm in step.